You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
An apology from the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Last week on the Dara O'Brien episode, Stuart Goldsmith referred to an amusing visual joke that, a sort of prank, if you will, that he claimed was the work of Lloyd Langford. It has since come to Stuart Goldsmith's attention that this was actually the work of Ed Gamble, who supported Greg Davies on tour and used to frame out Greg's head when taking pictures of Greg with fans. Ed Gamble has got in touch via text message and made it clear in capital letters that it was his joke. So please strike from your mind the idea that Lloyd Langford came up with this amusing little prankette, and instead remember it was Ed Gamble. Ed Gamble.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is Nazim Hussain, a brilliant comic who I managed to grab while he was at the Soho Theatre in London. And we had a lovely little chat in his apartment that the Soho Theatre was laying on for him. I don't know how that works. Maybe he was renting it from them. Don't know. But either way, as you can hear, there are some sound issues because it was a bit of a building site next door. I don't think they'll interfere too badly with the meat of the show. We move at one point and you'll probably hear an odd little pop as the acoustic completely changes. But nonetheless, really, really pleased to speak to Nazim. Such a nice guy. He's the other half of Fear of a Brown Planet with Amir Rahman, who I interviewed some 30 or 40 episodes ago, something like that. Fabulous comic in his own right. Really, really great show that I saw the previous night in Soho. And as you'll hear, has got some very interesting. I mean, what a key kind of member of the Muslim community. In Australia, and Young Australian of the Year, or was it Young Australian or Young Muslim of the Year? I'm not sure. But he, you know, accolades, and like a proper, compared to how most comics that I know get into this job as a result of just kind of dropping out of a regular society, he's done completely the other way around. He's like a really useful member of society, and he's become a comic on top of that. So I know you're going to enjoy this. This is the lovely and very, very funny Nazim Hussain. So tell me about your show at Soho.
We're on.
Show at Soho. This is my first solo run in London or anywhere outside of Australia. Actually, well, I did Belgium and Paris, but it's been heaps of fun. To be honest, super nervous because I know I just Soho Theatre, just the standard, like the sorts of acts that they have on are just awesome, like people, comedians that I'm kind of fans of, like,
yeah.
So being there on stage as myself, like not hiding behind a duo, not hiding behind Fear of a Brown Planet, was intimidating actually. But it's only taken, like, I think last night I felt like comfortable. Just, I don't know, it sounds like I'm a super insecure guy, but I just, yeah, it's just something about London. Just London is a big city, big. It's just an intimidating city in my brain.
Psychologically, yeah.
Psychologically, yeah. So it's last night. I think psychologically, I felt in the groove. I'm gonna say it's because I was a little bit sick as well for Monday and Tuesday. I just wasn't really mentally all there on stage.
You were phenomenally relaxed when I saw you on Tuesday. I was like, I couldn't tell that there was a psychological barrier yeah. there for you, because I was like, this is great. He's just sort of ambling out on stage yeah. and like.
No, but you know what? Like, that's so. You came to see. I asked you when you came to this apartment about which night did you come? You said Tuesday, and I was like, oh, that's that shit, no, where I was all shit. But the thing is, like, when I was doing those jokes on Tuesday, there were times when I heard myself and I thought, I've never done it at this tone before, because I'm normally yelling or yes. just like super animated. So it was like the being a little bit sick kind of did alter my performance. But I think people probably thought, well, no one would have known any different. They would have thought that yes. he just performs casually like that. But
yeah, a little bit. So are you normally more intense? I've seen some of your YouTube videos. I've seen a couple of bits from the show, the drinking after work drinks bit, which is obviously like a signature bit of yours. And it's on YouTube. It's a little bit. There's a bit more. You're attacking the mountain a bit more.
I often see my own spit flying into the spotlight.
Yes,
I didn't see much of that on Tuesday. You know, when my friends or other comedians imitate me doing stand up, they're always just like, they just yell a lot.
Well, I have to say, having not seen much of you, I've only seen a couple of YouTube clips, and I'm aware of.
I don't watch my stand up on YouTube, but that's it's all yelly.
Yeah, there's. I think because I see you in the same frame as Armour Redman from Fear of a Brown Planet you did together, and he's been on the show, and I saw him at Soho, had a conversation with him. I suppose, like, the way he frames himself is like his big publicity shot that he's used both times now is like the microphone that's a hand grenade. And it's like, yeah, I'm spitting truth.
That's right. We actually had that photo shoot together. But yeah, go on.
Okay,
that
go was, on. Well, what was your...
It was with Tony Briggs. He's a guy that's... He did the photo... he took the photo of my current poster photo, which is me in a floral shirt with a floral wallpaper background.
Yes.
Which was just like...
It's not very hand grenade-y.
To be honest, I don't even know what it said or what it... He said, I've got this funny shirt, and why don't you wear it, and then maybe we can Photoshop that. And I just thought, oh, I'll wear it. Mucked around with a couple of facial expressions, and we did it. And then of all the other ones which I had planned, which was just me doing goofy, funny comedy phase, that one obviously was the most striking and stood out. And in a way, I think it kind of captures maybe my style of comedy. You know, it's just a little bit silly, a little bit colourful, but, you know, just... I don't know. I've got a few things I need to get off my chest.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that's what it is. Okay, so just go into that a bit more, because I think that's interesting. I think once in a blue moon, I'll have a shoot and I'll go, yeah, that's where I'm at, or that's where I'm at the moment.
Yeah.
So what is that?
Well,
so
just I didn't think about it at the time.
Sure.
But when we were going through photos for this, for this, you know, Melbourne Comedy Festival, for Adelaide and for Sydney, whatever, and for London. We were going through all the photos, and I think, that stood out the most, but it also kind of, I think it's a little bit different to most usual comedy posters, but I think it kind of says a little bit about who I am. Like, it's, compared to Armair anyway, like, we both kind of have similar political views, almost, you know, but I think mine's a little bit more sugar-coated. It's easier to digest.
Yes.
And that photo kind of, I think...
It's less kind of combative in approach.
Yeah, I think so. He's a nice guy that hates white people.
Yeah.
Whereas Amra says, no, I'm not very happy, and I'm here to kill white people.
Yes.
Or encourage that. But, you know, it's... we have very different styles, but I think that photo really got it.
And
Amra's one was like, you know, with the grenade, but... When I think Tony started taking those photos of Armour holding the microphone with the grenade, like, he looked properly angry, and Tony had to say, listen, just, you know, you got
to... We want people to come to the show.
Yeah. But he got the right balance, because Armour is a funny, goofy guy. He's actually, like, offstage, he's the most silly, childish guy a lot of the time. He loves, he's a kid, he loves comic books.
Yeah.
We'd walk past a comic book shop, or, you know, and he'd just stay there and just look at stupid figurines for ages. I make fun of his collection. But, you know, so that photo, I think, really kind of got that goofiness as well in there too. Like, in his facial expression, looks like a bit of a kid.
And what was it about the ones that you... Because I've never really talked about photos on this show before. And it's interesting because I suppose we're all in kind of pre-Edinburgh mode at the moment.
Yeah,
loads of British comics are like, well, we've just had this conversation. We've just signed off on it and the rest of it. What is it about the ones that you turned down that you thought didn't represent you?
Yeah... Well, I think it's just like, hey, just pure funny guy with comedy hands. You know, the hands that are just kind of like, what? That just says, I just get some funny things to say. Like, whereas I think I wanted to have a little bit of an edge, something that was, everybody does though, but it's just, there's no real science to it, in my opinion. I think
there's no real
science to it. I think it's kind of accidental, coming across the right photo. And, you know, you could take 10 photos wearing the same outfit and one facial expression might be like, it might stand out and pierce through.
I just want to get the photographer to just hold down the button. So just click, click, click. I'm just going to do a load of faces, and we will trust that one in a thousand of them sums me up. Or at least I don't hate.
But you know what? I don't actually. We were talking about this. I don't even know what posters do, to be honest, because you either recognize someone's face or you don't. I don't know how many people go, "That's a funny poster. I'm going to see that guy." I don't know, and I hope that's not too cynical. Because I know a lot of people spend a lot of time. We all spend time.
Yeah. But I think part of the reason we all spend time on it is it's one of the very few things we can control.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? That is true. Imagine if you could spend all the time that you want to spend on your poster. Imagine if you could spend that time on vetting the audience. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly right. Well, that's true. So I guess that's what we do. We hold on to the poster design, and the font's too big or the price is too small, and, you know, so it's all...
Sure. So this is your first time in Soho.
First time. Well, I've done Soho with Arma as part of Fear of Brown Planet.
Yes,
that was a few years ago.
And your relationship with Arma, I was remembering from our conversation, me and him, is you're very intertwined. Like your kind of genesis as comics was very much like you were both in the same. Like you met. Well, where did you meet?
We kind of met doing community work. Actually, we sort of met. Yeah, so I was doing community work in the Muslim community for a fairly long time. I used to study at a madrasa, so like a Muslim Saturday or Sunday school. And then once you finish studying, you then go into to a sort of teaching position. And then you just sort of help out at camps and community events and quiz nights. And I used to be the guy that used to just, when the projector breaks down, I'd be up on stage and just, you know, just keep people entertained or listening and just make jokes about the fat guy in the crowd and the old imam. And, you know, I didn't really have any boundaries.
At a
madrasa. And so I'd make the Muslim community laugh. You know, I was that silly, clowny guy. And then one time...
I think you get killed in the movie, don't you?
That's true. But that kind of just progressed. I just kept doing that. And then whenever I became the go-to guy, the go-to MC in the community, if there was a boring mosque fundraiser, I'd be the guy. And people would actually... And I remember the first time I got flown across to Sydney to host like some Muslim community fundraiser or awards night. I felt like I was a proper celebrity. And, you know, so I flew there and I emceed and I did my jokes about getting caught making wudu, which is the wash that Muslims do before they pray, by a non-Muslim co-worker. And, you know, that was my first kind of bit, you know, and people would laugh. And it had like a 7-minute setup before the small payoff. But, you know.
I mean, that is incredibly niche, really, isn't it? So, like, niche. Has anyone else had that? I mean, I can't imagine Arma at the time was doing observational stuff about...
Well, so then what happened? Yeah, then Allah Made Me Funny came out. So there are these three Muslim comedians in the United States who I only heard of. Someone sent me a link online, and I remember listening to their comedy, and it was about the Muslim experience. It was kind of about what I was doing at community functions, but they actually were doing it as proper stand-up, and they were touring it. It was a show, and it was slick. And I literally memorized the entire hour of comedy. There was three of them at the time, and they were coming out to Australia, and they were like my favorite comedians on the planet at the time, and they were looking for a local MC or just a local. They were like, who's a local the Muslim comedian? There was no Muslim comedians. It was just me doing the stuff when the projector breaks and the jokes about getting caught by a non-Muslim coworker washing your feet in the sink. So they said, do you want to do it? And I said, oh, hell yeah. And it was at a proper theater with 1500 people, and I've never properly performed. So I went on stage and didn't know what to do. I just started telling these stories I never practiced them. I just sort of just told them, riffed them off and they were okay. Like, but I thought I was hilarious because, you know, I'd get the usual kind of laughs. But then I saw those guys perform and properly rip it.
Okay.
Azhar.
You were on before them.
I was on before them.
Okay. So you didn't have to follow any of the pro guys.
But like lots of people knew who I was. They're like, oh, it's Nazim, the guy from the local mosque or the madrasa. And then so I do the jokes, and then, you know, then they came on, and afterwards they were like, yeah, young Nazim, you know, there's actually a science and a method to writing comedy. You don't just sort of get up and just try and be funny. Like,
with the best will in the world, this is a real thing.
And they literally sat me down and kind of talked to me about how comedy is written and how it's practiced and how, you know,
oh my god,
comedy. Like, so it was almost like it was eye-opening for me. And Arma
that is I would say that is the almost the exact opposite of most comedians birth of a comedian. I think certainly the reason I'm doing this show is because I spent 10 years as a comic not knowing what it was I did. Or, you know, literally no one had ever sat down. This is my attempt to sit down with people and go, so how do you do it? And you got that after gig number one.
Well, you know what?
They sat you down in the green room.
They just said, listen, mate. Well, basically what they said was, they said, you've actually got to think. What I walked away with was that, oh, you've got to think about what you're going to say before you get on stage. You can't just sort of go, oh, I'll tell that. There's a funny story about this and a funny story. Like, you've actually got to think about how you set it up and present it. And so Armour and I just hung around with these guys for ages, and then we decided after that we were going to, well, myself, Armour, and this guy, Waleed Ali, who now is a television presenter for kind of news program in Australia, we thought we'd do an hour for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival because we'd seen these guys and we thought, man, you know, we can do it too, like in Australia. So we called up the Melbourne Comedy Festival. We said, we would like to book a room to do the comedy festival. Can we do that, please? And they said, oh, have you done stand-up before? And they said, we said, no, we haven't done stand-up, but, you know, we want to do an hour. And they said, you should maybe try this open mic competition called Raw Comedy. And so I said, what's that? And they said, you just got to do 5 minutes. And I said, 5 minutes? Man, I got several stories I can tell. And so when I stage did my 5 minutes, it was pretty average. But I made it through a few rounds. Decided to do the same thing, and yeah, that actually taught us how to properly write then, I guess.
Okay.
You know,
so you were there, like, presumably backstage at the first time you did Raw. So you were there going, well, my last gig was 1,500 people.
And I got about three laughs. So I just thought, you know, but then the audience was Muslim and non-Muslim. So it was kind of, it was a different experience.
Because
it wasn't just making my community laugh anymore. It was community people. And we packed the pub out with Muslim women wearing hijabs and guys with beards, and just, it was a weird...
Oh, for your Raw gig?
For the Raw gig, yeah.
Okay.
And then there were, like, you know, non-Muslim white people drinking beer and alcohol. And as soon as I finished my set, the pub would just clear. All these Muslims would just leave. That taught me, I guess, that was kind of a quick learning curve into how to...
Okay.
Get into
and then you ended up going on with Armour and doing the Fear of a Brown Planet tour. So that was how long was it after the Raw experience?
So maybe like until six months. 6 months.
So you rang Melbourne back up and go, so, okay, I've done five minutes.
Come on, give us the hour. So we did the Fringe Festival at the end of the year. So we did that in April, and then we did the Fringe in like September, and then that's sold out pretty quickly because of community word of mouth, and I think people were merely interested in also the idea of Muslims doing stand-up comedy talking about politics and race relations.
Yeah, absolutely no one was doing it.
So if no one was doing it, so people weren't convinced necessarily of how funny we were, but it was certainly going to be
culturally interesting to go and see it. You're going to get interviewed presumably everywhere. Well, the coverage is going to be enormous.
We genuinely didn't anticipate that. We had no idea. We just thought, oh, we're gonna do this, you know, like Allah Made Me Funny, and we just thought, but we didn't think we would get in a radio interview or a newspaper interview. But all of a sudden, we had people asking us to do interviews, so it just came out of nowhere.
Looking back on the quality of that show now,
oh God,
you might have answered my question, because I would, like, if I was your manager at the time, and I don't know what your kind of management representation issues were, I'd be going, oh guys, we've got something here, this could be huge, get really good first and then drop it and all the rest of it, but you just barreled straight in.
There's three of us, the third guy, Muhammad Lacey, a good friend of ours, he ended up doing other stuff, he's a community worker now, but the three of us, we kind of had like a tight 20-ish each.
Okay.
And for the few days leading up to it, we stuck ourselves in this room and we just sort of rehearsed. We said material to each other and we just sort of tightened bits up. And,
it was a bunch of young lads, let's put on a show here.
We've never done a gig in a pub or anything like outside of Raw, so it was just us cramming with each other. It was almost like an exam, and we were stressed out. We're like, guys, come on, we're going to take it seriously. We've got a show to make. So we did the week of shows and we sold that out, and then we did an extra big one in a 300-seat room. That was the most exciting thing we'd ever done. And on that show, like, we had a manager come, and we had like a television producer come, and then afterwards they both wanted to meet us, and they were like, you know, you guys are really great, we want to sign. So we signed up to this, to a manager who was our previous manager. He introduced us to our current manager, and things just sort of went from there. And then, you know, that's kind of how you understand how the industry starts to work, and you get to become familiar with other comedians. We didn't really know any other comedians at the time, just famous guys. Like, we shared a change in one night with Arj Barker, and that was probably the first comedian we'd ever really met. We were massive fans of him.
Did you miss out on a certain amount of comedy upbringing? Did you miss out on the kind of like the circuit, like turning up at open spots, making friends amongst the newer comedians?
Totally.
I mean, they must have been like, who are these fucking guys that are suddenly selling everywhere else? We don't even know them.
There was that. And the thing is, we'd sell out really quickly. And yeah, a lot of people that came were Muslim, or they were brown, or they weren't necessarily, you know, they weren't white, or, you know, anyone that kind of identified as being different would come to the show. And they could be white, but they might be, you know, they might be gay, or they might be someone who's politically very left of center. And those sorts of people were coming to the show. And some of the comedians, who some of them now I'm good friends with, but, you know, at the time they would bitch behind our backs and say, oh, those guys, they just bring their friends, and their friends come over and over again. And the implication was that we aren't actually funny. We don't deserve that audience.
Yeah.
And look, yeah, I can understand where that comes from, because a lot of people did have, you know, you have to sort of earn your stripes and build an audience from scratch and prove, and that audience represents how funny you are, I guess, in the eyes of lots of comedians. So we necessarily, I think we felt we had to prove ourselves on the same stage as other comedians. So we would then start to do pub spots or like gala, you know, just we would have to, well, I think we did sometimes do those sorts of spots to sort of show to the industry that we actually are funny. We can make Muslims laugh. We can make non-Muslims laugh. We can make people laugh. We don't necessarily need to just make our community laugh. And then I think once people saw that, then they, you know, we sort of earned that respect. But it wasn't the most pleasant introduction to the comedy industry.
Sure.
You know.
So this is Nazim. Thanks very much to Nazim for coming on the show, for having me round. Also met his charming wife. Very, very lovely people. So more from him in just a moment. Just a couple of things, really. There's probably still tickets left for Adam Buxton on the 7th of July. You can go to sohotheatre.com and enter the discount code FAFF. That's FAFF. And you can... I think that gets you 25% off your tickets. I think there are 10 of that drops to $7.50, or they might be lower and it drops them lower still. I can't remember quite what we plugged for there. My bad. But go sohotheatre.com to hear me interview Adam Buxton, see me interview Adam Buxton live. So that's all of that. I've got a bunch of previews. I've updated my gig list finally. You can go to stuartgoldsmith.co.uk and you can have a little look at my gig list. There's some videos and bits and bobs. They're all vastly out of date. That's the next part of the greater website overhaul. But you can certainly see my gig list there, which has got some London previews at London and other places. And what else do I need to tell you? Yes, 7th of July. Do come to myself and James Acaster kicking off a day of previews at the Top Secret Comedy Club in Drury Lane in London. That's www.thetopsecretcomedyclub.co.uk. Should have details. That's the 11th of July, the day before my birthday. James is on at 1 p.m. I'm on at 2:30 p.m. Then you can stick around for Omar Hamdi and Alfie Brown after that. I will probably do that, but I will also be drinking, so I reserve the right to be on a speedboat by then. That's a little bit of birthday fun for me and a chance for you to come and see two excellent previews in an excellent, excellent comedy club for absolutely no money. So come along and do that. That's all for now. If you're into supporting the show, you can always do that. Comedianscomedian.com, press the PayPal button, there's a little donate button there, and you can decide what you think the show is worth to you. Do you think it's worth £1 an episode? Has it made that difference to your life? If there was a thing, I was thinking someone should invent this, it's not going to be me, so have the idea, but if there was part of the podcast app where, as the podcast kind of pinged up on your screen, a little one-off button that said, would you like to donate 20p? And you could just press yes, no. You'd go no, you'd go no. And maybe on like the fifth Comic-Con pod, you go, yeah, I'll give him 20p and just press the button. Imagine if it were that easy. But it's not that easy, so you need to make an effort. But think about it, that would what, 120 episodes at 20p each? Why, that would be, I mean, you do the maths, it's more than 20 quid, asleep. It's probably less than 35. Can't do it in my head. The point is, if you go to comedianscomedian.com, you can press the donate button and you can kick me a little something back to say thank you for doing the show and to pay me for some of the many, many hours that go into it to support the show. I am going to be taking this show to LA Podfest, which is the podcast festival in September. I'm sort of gate crashing, really, so this isn't an official announcement. I'm just going to turn up. I've booked a place in the hotel. I'm going to get a flight. Mike Sheldon's podcast bursary from a few weeks ago, that was enough to sort the hotel out. Now I've got to pay for the flights. So if you fancy donating to the show, there has never been a better time. And also join the Facebook group. You can have a look at the T-shirt options and help me decide make my final decision for which merch we go with. I'm going to be selling some of that at Edinburgh and probably selling some of that in the internet. I'm going to sell the T-shirts in the internet. It's a podcast show. That's the best place for them. That's everything. I think that's everything. Yeah. Oh, and you can go to patreon.com/comcompod. If you'd like to support via Patreon. But let's face it, No one knows what that is. I mean, noodle around, have a look at Patreon, P-R-T-R-E-O-N. There's some great stuff on there. It's sort of like Kickstarter for regular donations. So patreon.com/comcompod. And that's all we need to talk about for now. Thanks for listening. Here is the rest of my conversation with Nazim Hussain.
So speaking as someone who obviously was, we're talking about the community and the comedy community, you came to comedy from the perspective of being in a religious community. How did they feel? How did your mosque feel about you doing stand-up? Well, presumably in clubs where alcohol is sold and things like that.
So at the same time, so alongside doing this stand-up thing for the first time, myself and a bunch of friends who weren't, none of them were funny or comedy people, we actually started a community television show. So it was myself, an eye surgeon, this older guy. There's another guy who's a son of a mufti who runs an Islamic books and clothing store.
What's a mufti?
Oh, so a mufti's like a religious jurist, like someone who makes fatwas, basically.
Okay.
religious, Islamic legal conclusions on issues. So,
okay.
Anything from, yeah. So, but also a position of seniority in Australia. So we kind of created this position called the Mufti of Australia, which means the highest religious figure. But it was kind of just this randomly made up thing just to sort of appease newspapers so that when they wanted an answer or something, we could go, oh, that guy is kind of the leader. So, it's just a bunch of us, really. We were kind of annoyed with what we saw on TV about Muslims, so we thought, well, let's just create our own television show. So we approached, there's this channel called Channel 31, which I don't know if you guys have an equivalent sort of community television station here, but it's basically, it's just...
Whenever I think of community television, my only reference point is Wayne's World. Because I don't have a, you know, as far as I know, there isn't an equivalent thing.
Well, it's kind of like, it's this, you can have anything from this show that just shows fish swimming around in a tank for half an hour to like what we created, which is called Salam Cafe, which was just Muslims sitting on a panel talking about life. And then I would do this segment where I'd go out and vox pop people or do sort of sketches. So, you know, that joke about getting caught washing my feet in the sink by a coworker, that became a sketch. We filmed that. In fact, I think some of these are still on YouTube. And I'm trying to contact the guy to take them off because they're just properly amateur. But we did that show, and that reached actually the broadest. Well, it reached more Muslims than any of my community stand-up things ever did. I think it was rating like 100,000 on community television, which was phenomenal in Australia, to the point that we won like community television awards, and then that got them picked up onto one of the free-to-air networks, so one of five called SBS. So I was kind of used to receiving critical and complimentary feedback from the Muslim community. A lot of older Muslims, you know, conservative Muslims, I guess, were... some of them were uncomfortable with the idea that we were, freely interacting with members of the opposite sex, that there was music on the show. Some people had, you know, perspectives, you know, some people believe that music isn't permissible in Islam. Like, that's a very conservative opinion, but it is an opinion in the community. Also, I think older people who were used to watching Muslims on TV be ridiculed were not used to seeing Muslims on TV talk about their own experiences and laugh. So I think when they saw Muslims on TV joking and laughing about their own experiences, Muslims are making fun of us. Yeah. And so we did get a lot of people saying, why are you making fun of the religion? And we were never making fun of the religion. In fact, we never spoke about religious life. We just spoke about life being Muslim in Australia. And in a way, it was kind of... yeah, it was propaganda, I guess, in a way. We were trying to tell broader Australia that we were normal people. It was that kind of, which was a bit of a sad premise that we sort of needed to humanise ourselves. But that was sort of the reality of life in Australia back in 2005 and 6 and 7 and 8 when we did this show. So that was a Muslim community response. But the response from the broader non-Muslim community was crazy. Like, you would think naturally people that watch an obscure station like Channel 31, this community channel, that they would kind of be open-minded, but we had all sorts of emails and from people saying things like, you know, stop pretending that you're not violent terrorists because we know you are. This is just an act. Or people would email and say, I didn't know Muslim women could speak English, and we're going to kill you. Like, we got death threats. So by the time I was doing stand up properly, that was a couple of years later, I was sort of used to just hearing from people. And you begin to understand what feedback is worthwhile listening to and what isn't. And also, like, I like the feedback from the Muslim community. Even if it's critical, You know, even if people say, you should be doing this, you should be doing that, because it means that they feel invested in the show, and they see themselves kind of through you, or they see that you are speaking on behalf of them, that you have a platform that you need to you need to use that properly. So it was almost like, this sounds weird, but it felt like, it was an honor to sort of, you know, to know that people looked at you and said, oh, that's kind of, he's one of our, he's our guy, or that show, you know, because they go to work and you see like cab drivers or like just kids at school go to school and their friends would say, oh, I saw that show, Salam Cafe, or they'd show their friends like a funny Muslim clip, and it was something for them to feel proud about. So for me, it was almost like this is a show that gave Muslims pride, and when it didn't, we knew about it, but it kind of came from a good place ultimately. Yes. People wanted us to do better because it meant their lives would potentially be easier, or they had something to show off about.
You you sound so kind of positive, even finding like the positives in negative comments about stuff.
I mean, see, that's a positive negative comment. When you get, you know, when you get comments from racists, like that's the right sort of hate. You know, when you get people saying you're a terrorist, like if you're pissing off that sort of person, you're
that's
probably
the
saying
right
the right sort of thing.
Of hate. You know, the right sort of hate. How optimistic are you?
You know,
how unusual are you within the Muslim community in Australia? To what extent are you? Are there lots of other young Muslims who are considering a career in comedy?
Well, there are other Muslim comedians in Australia now. Like there's a guy by the name of Khalid Khalifullah. He's a young comedian starting out. There are a couple other guys. There's not a whole bunch. There was a time when there was about five. But then, you know, it's just a difficult career.
It's an unusual circuit. Like, yeah, yeah. It's an unusual coincidence of circumstances, yeah. I suppose, I suppose if you're the funny guy that gets up and covers at the madrasa, then there's really only needs to be one guy. So no one else is going to get that.
Look, it's not a big market. Australia, we have the Muslim community is about 500,000, but yeah, London's 10% Muslim. Like it's a really tight community over there. So we sort of all know each other in a way. Like it's not like here where it's almost just like broader, like there is no Muslim community. The Muslims are just everywhere. So it's not like it's you're part of a club here so much.
Sure.
Whereas in Australia, you feel like you're part of like this kind of smaller club. Like it's a community. It's a tighter community. Whereas here, it's just, you know.
To what extent do you think your optimism is? And we won't spend all of our time talking about your faith, but it's very unusual for me, the fact that you're a comic that talks about their faith is like I want to ask all sorts of questions about how your faith supports you. Like, you know, we all know comedians are just a bunch of basket cases. You seem like a really happy, optimistic person who is using comedy to make yourself happy and to educate people. Whereas a lot of comics that we know, that we'll both know, are kind of like wild-eyed loners trying to cure their own personal isolation and depression.
But it's kind of the same thing. Like, the Muslim community in Australia is isolated and does feel depressed. And for me, the biggest joy I get out of doing any of this seeing my community laugh. Like, to be honest, I feel emotional every time I even think about that. But seeing, like, a community that is normally sad laugh, that nothing literally makes me happier. It's like it's a community that's used to being humiliated. And, yeah, if I can be that guy...
That's a fascinating perspective. Like, it's almost like the kid who learns to make people laugh at school to stop bullying them. Like, you're kind of drawing a parallel between that and the whole Muslim community.
No, I'm not making the whole... But as in, if there are Muslims in my community... You know, if I'm on stage and there are Muslims in front of me who are laughing, that makes me happy. Because we don't have much to laugh about as a community. Individually in our lives, obviously, we do. But as a community, we don't have much to celebrate. Like... You turn on the TV, like, whenever you hear a Muslim on TV, we're getting smashed. We're getting misrepresented. You know, you hear stories of Muslims just getting harassed in public. It's not a happy place. People change their names in Australia from like Muhammad to Michael or Osama to Sam. Like, it's not, no one, you know, if you say you're a Muslim in Australia, you know that someone's going to immediately think about terrorism or misogyny or something negative. So when we can kind of talk about these experiences and feel happy or feel empowered by these things that normally make us sad, that's great. Like, and that's, for me, I feel like, well, this is now, if I can do this as a career, I feel happy, I feel satisfied, and I'm seeing people escape for a little bit.
I feel like in the last 10 years, I feel like it's become a running joke that Australians are racist in a way that it wasn't before that, in a way that it wasn't that wasn't a joke. That wasn't an accepted stereotype of the Australian people. And I'm not kind of conforming or confirming that stereotype. But I feel like I suppose what I'm getting at is and I'm using obviously racism, as you said in the show. You know, when people go, oh, you know, this is my little loophole. It's actually Islamophobia.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It isn't racism.
Because it's not a race. But...
Yeah, exactly right. But let's lump those ideas of racism and Islamophobia together, as you've done in your show. Do you think Australia is getting worse? Do you think it's getting more racist?
Oh, it's not getting better. Like, it's not getting better. Well, I guess the reality is Australia is becoming more and more multicultural. Young people are becoming – I think a lot of young people are becoming less convinced by what they hear in the media and by politicians and people of any influence. You know, they're sort of tuning out and they're watching YouTube videos or they're reading articles online. Like, you can connect to the world and you can understand what the rest of the world is doing. So you understand how silly and backwards Australia is. But, yeah, I don't think things are getting better. Like, politicians are still trading on racism and bigotry and hysteria and, you know, our policies towards Indigenous Australians are just becoming more and more oppressive. The government's now trying to close down all, you know, remote Aboriginal communities in Western Australia and, you know, that's happening without much in the way of that. Like, it's just hard with our asylum seeker policy. Like, well, I heard a columnist here talking about how the UK needs to – or Britain needs to – become more Australian with regards to how harsh you guys are towards asylum seekers. Like, so, Australia is becoming more and more conservative politically and just less and less things to celebrate, like, in terms of social policies anyway. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think the question whether is Australia a racist country, I don't know what that means. Does that mean that we have a majority of racist people or does it mean that all Australians are racist? I think what is important in that question or thinking about Australian racism is that there is a big problem of racism that never really gets addressed. Like, when we talk about racism in Australia, the conversations tend to be by white people. Like, you turn on TV and you sort of see panels of white people discussing what is or isn't racist. Mm. You know, that would never happen if you're talking about sexism. You'd never see a bunch of men talking about what is or isn't offensive to women. Like, people would call that out. You know, similarly with homophobia or whatever. Like, it just – but when it comes to racism – for whatever reason, we are just really defensive about it and we're just not able to talk about it comfortably. Because I think in Australia, we think if we talk about racism, it means we have a problem with racism and it just affirms, I don't know.
Sense of like the average Australian doesn't want to accept that it exists. You need to accept it exists in order to talk about it. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, I think, you know what? Yeah, perhaps. I think so. I think that's what it is. I think if we talk about racism, it means that we are all responsible and no one really wants – it is an uncomfortable thing to happen. And that's why with any, you know, in the UK, the US, even in Australia, like that sort of – the conversation needs to change and the way it will change is by non-white communities sort of standing up and making as much noise as they can and getting in the way of the way things normally run to sort of force that conversation to the fore. Like it's not going to happen because sympathetic white people are all of a sudden enlightened. You know, it's just – that's not how – you change that conversation. It needs to come from.
Is there any?
But the thing is, the funny thing is, in Australia, we've had like our own civil rights movement 50 years ago. Like it's, but we just forget all these things, and it just so you know. Well, when I'm here in the UK, I feel properly comfortable. Like you know, you can be different. Like to be British to me, it feels like you can be and look whatever you want to be and look like. Whereas in Australia, it's just normatively white, and you turn on the TV, it's all white people, and it's just such a different place.
I saw a poster on the way here for the Entourage movie.
Oh, really?
And it might as well, it's like the poster is five identical white guys in sunglasses. That's so funny. I saw it might as well be called White Douchebags. Just, hey, like that.
Well, that's, you know what?
I'm not familiar with the movie. The joke might be that they're douchebags. I've no idea.
But that poster would stand out here in the UK because London is so diverse. And it's so diverse, and people expect diversity because they expect to see themselves in movies and in television shows. to the point that, like, Neighbours, the only reason Neighbours actually had an Indian family on the season for one season was because audiences in London were upset and they just kind of kept bombarding producers over there with that sort of feedback. So they put an Indian family in, which lasted one season, and they kicked them out of the suburb. I mean, they're out now. But, I don't know if you... There was a bit of a thing at the start of this year where... So the guy, Waleed Ali, he was a guy that worked on that show Salaam Cafe with me. Together, we've done some things here and there in the community, but he was sort of the Muslim spokesperson for a while. He was on the Islamic Council of Victoria. He is a journalist, but now he's the host of this show called The Project, which is a big...
I've heard of it. I've never seen it. I've heard that it's a massive show.
Yeah, so it's a nightly news and current affairs program, but it's kind of like delivered lightly. And anyway, he was announced as a new host of The Project, but they put my photo in the newspaper when they announced it, and it became a bit of a thing. But like, it just sort of shows, like, there are so few, like, me and him are the only two brown people on Australian television. We'll get to my show later, I guess, but we haven't mentioned that. But they sort of made that mistake, which sort of just explains, like, I don't know. It's a different place, Australia. It just wouldn't happen here in the UK.
Let's talk about the show, Legally Brown. I've never seen an episode. I've seen some clips on YouTube, and it really made me laugh, man. I saw the Uncle Sam character, and there's a lot of how much, like, the bits that I saw with the Uncle Sam character, and trying to, what was the, which bit was it? It was, trying to move all of the Tasmanians. All of the Muslim people to Tasmania, and all of the non-Muslims in Tasmania to Australia, and you're going to rename it Islamania.
Well, that's a character. So the character was born out of the community television show Salaam Cafe, where I basically play like a Muslim uncle who, I guess, epitomises every white non-Muslim sphere about Muslim men. You know, that they look a certain way, and that they want to take over Australia. And Uncle Sam, you know, he's a prank character. So I go out in the street and I speak to white people about these ideas and sort of see how they react and sort of...
I did notice on that episode, lots of the white people you spoke, and presumably there were editing decisions made by you or whoever else was editing the program. Lots of the white people you spoke to were sort of going, no, I don't think we should do that. You can't move them. I mean, you can't do that. It was not that it made it any less funny, but I was sort of expecting it to be like an expose of the Islamophobia of the Australian in the street.
So when Uncle Sam was on community television, we got to really push it. But when we got onto SBS, they sort of wanted, you know, because I think... showing racism on TV can be really uncomfortable for people, or showing Islamophobia. And so the network kind of wanted it to be, you know, to expose a little bit of that, but not too much. The idea was to move Muslims to Tasmania and to keep mainland Australia purely non-Muslim. But when I spoke to people on the street in that character, a lot of Australians actually, you know, they were obviously upset that, you know, we would be taking over a state. But they thought, you know what, now genuinely that's probably a good idea, because at least... then there's no threat of any terrorism in Australia, because you get what you want. You've got your own state, you know, like, we'll concede Tasmania. So I thought that was hilarious. The premise I thought was funny, and I thought, you know...
And their reactions were funny, and then SBS said you can't show those reactions because it reflects Australians in too bad a light.
Yeah, too bad a light, and it kind of... What good is that? What's the point of that?
What's the point of only showing the nice people?
I think we had a lot of disagreements about the character, and I think the character can be read in a couple of different ways. Like, if people take the character seriously, that's funny because the character's so ridiculous and he's saying such stupid things.
Yes, how could you possibly take it seriously?
But if you show reasonable Australians reacting to, like, it sort of goes the other way. There was a really conservative British party who posted an Uncle Sam clip and said, yes, this guy's finally funny, because they thought I was making fun of Islam, which actually pissed me off, because it kind of goes the exact opposite direction. I wasn't necessarily happy with editing decisions.
Okay. Is that show still running?
Well, we did two seasons of Legally Brown, and now we're working on some other projects. So that was like a mixed bag show. So I did sketch, hidden camera stuff.
Yeah, I only really saw that.
Or like the stuff interacting with public.
Is your pet racist? Which, again, very funny bit, like set up with you in a shirt at a focus group with a whiteboard, you know, kind of going, here, what is this, like a spray?
Well, it was basically, we had all sorts of, like, basically I was running a focus group, and we had a bunch of people in there, and most of them were actors except for one person. And
okay.
We'd be testing ridiculous products, and we sort of want to see how...
So everyone else was in on it, apart from the one person.
Apart from one person. Okay. So we want to see if that would go along with a stupid idea, if the mob did. And most of the time they did. So, one of the products was a de-bigotry pet medication. And so, if your pet is racist, you can spray this into your dog's face, and then it, And so we showed all these stupid statistics, and by the end, most people sort of accepted what was being presented because everybody else was putting their hand up when I said,
Yeah, okay.
Or one which cured your gayness. We proved that it worked by having an actor pretend she was, she was gay, and then by the time she took this pill, she was straight. And so, I'm like, oh, really? I could give that to some of my friends. And I'm like, really? He has a problem because he's homosexual. I can cure him. So that was
the genuine audience member saying that.
Yeah, genuine. But then we couldn't put that to air because it kind of, again, it's uncomfortable.
It's too effective a sting. Oh my god.
it's difficult kind of working with networks sometimes. What happens?
And what are your plans then for the next project? Are you going to have any more editorial control over it?
I did have a lot of editorial control over Legally Bound. I wrote most of the things, and we had a couple other writers working on the show as well. So, the ideas I guess I came up with, and then we would write them together, and the network would edit certain things out, but what was left was still my writing, and it was still what I had in mind, but it wasn't the entire idea. But that's what when you're doing anything on television, that's kind of what you're getting into, especially if you're a no-name. I had no runs on the board with television, so doing that show was just like a kind of gamble for the network. And it worked, and, we got nominated for a Logie Award, which was just like a total surprise, and it kind of, meant that we have some cred now, I guess, mm-hmm. In the industry. And so now people are trusting us with another project or developing another idea anyway, which is more of a narrative, I think. So less of a mixed bag. I think we know what worked and what didn't work in Legally Brown.
So with regard to the writing of Legally Brown, you said you come up with the ideas yourself.
Yeah.
So and talk me through that process. Are you just with a notebook in hand? Are you sat at a laptop just kind of trying to come up with different ways you can...
Well, the thing is Legally Brown came about because the network SBS, which we'd had Salaam Cafe air on previously, were interested in me doing a show with them, and they kind of presented to me several ideas, and lots of them had kind of bits and pieces that I sort of liked but weren't entirely what I'd want to do. So I pitched to them an idea which said, hey, it's kind of like the Chappelle Show format in that it's stand-up based with pre-taped packages, but mm-hmm. I'd also do character stuff and sketches. So I worked with a producer who worked on Balls of Steel, who produced that in Australia. So I said, I've got a bunch of ideas, and he said, some of those ideas are great, but, that idea could cost like $2 million, Nazim, because that's a really, there's a rocket, wow, but underwater, that's a really, once I understood the parameters, like the production parameters, I could sort of go away and think of some ideas, just watch stuff, I'd bring an idea to the room and then we'd sort of work on it together. But essentially, I had a notepad, walk around, and just, if I had anything, I'd just write it down. My notes section in my phone, I use all the time. Sometimes I tend to write best when I'm upset or when I'm pissed off or frustrated about something. I think that's, if I'm upset, I tend to vent and it comes out sarcastically. And that's those sorts of things I think I find... I'm funniest, I think, when I'm a bit annoyed or frustrated.
That's good. Both those examples we've said, you can see their basis in a sarcastic response to something that's made you angry.
Yeah.
Oh, what should we do? Let's just move all the Muslims to Tasmania. Hang on a minute. Right there.
I think that's probably how it happened. I think I watched an early morning, a morning TV show, and there was a presenter on who was talking about, if Muslims just don't like it here, well, no one's asking them to stay. Why don't they do me? And so I think it was sort of an extension of that idea to sort of just quarantine Muslims in an island. It's sort of, when I'm yelling at the TV, I can tend to, that's almost, I know there's probably something in that frustration that could,
yes,
I could churn out on stage or on in a sketch.
Yeah, whenever I catch myself talking to the
TV. or just slamming my laptop shut, there's probably some comedy in there.
Okay. And how does that differ from how you write stand-up?
Not really. Oh, well, The way I come up with an idea for stand-up or TV is the same. You know, if I'm upset or, you know, if I find it funny, I'll write it down. But TV, there are so many more moving parts, you know. For something to be funny on television, like I found, is really, it's really difficult. And obviously I had so much help. I've got to, you know, I was working with people who had written television scripts before, mm-hmm. who knew about production, who knew about, like, editing and music and how all that works and in building and setting up a joke. So, yeah, for a joke to work on television, like, is difficult. And lots of the time it didn't work. We had a studio audience, so we could sort of see how that audience might react at home before it went to air, so we could cut stuff out.
Okay.
So we showed the sketches to the studio audience.
Yes.
You know, I did stand-up and said,
okay,
this out.
Yeah.
They would laugh at it or not laugh at it. And then we would go, that's shit. Let's go.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, my God, that bit was funny.
I wonder how many shows do that, because I've certainly been in TV studios where they've played out bits of existing stuff, but I haven't then seen the finished article and gone, oh, they cut that based on the fact no one laughed.
Well, that's the thing. Like, that's why I think, well, Legally Brown could have been a lot worse if we didn't have that studio, because we were able to see what would. You can literally see the audience. Whereas in lots of sketch shows, they're hoping that people at home are going to laugh, but you can't see, you just don't know. Twitter and Facebook are the only ways of finding out whether people are laughing at your sketches. Whereas stand-up, you know, it's completely different. You're on stage, if a joke tanks, you can save it, you can acknowledge it, you can just sort of move, you know, you can work with it, you can respond immediately. Whereas television, it's just, you're just like yelling into the dark.
And do you find with your stand-up that you're, did you ever go through like a process of finding your voice?
I'm finding my voice now. I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know where I'm at. Like,
you're still the same guy now at the Soho Theatre who is kind of filling in the gaps in between the projector breaking.
You could probably see you saw my show Tuesday night. Like, there are bits there that I wrote like a long time ago, because this is my first solo show. So it's kind of the best bits in a way. And there's stuff that I've written recently. And so the older bits for me, I'm like, oh man, why am I still doing that? You know, I've got I'm better than that now.
Is there stuff in it from Fear of a Brown Planet?
Well, the last show they did with Fear of a Brown Planet, there's a couple of jokes from there's a few jokes in that are still in
okay.
the solo show, because I, you know, why not?
Yeah. I mean, are you in a position where you're like, you're busy making TV, so stand-up takes a back seat?
Well, it did, and that's why I've only done the solo show now, whereas, you know, because I did two seasons of the show, so that was the last 2 years I was pretty flat out, and I couldn't focus on stand-up, whereas this year I just decided to lock in a tour and then force myself to write. So I sort of did that as soon as we finished production last year. I just kind of, well, I was supposed to focus on stand-up, but it took me months and months to get around to actually sitting down and just writing in a cafe. And I did that over about a week, to be honest, but most of the time was just dot points, and then I'd get up on stage. I had some trial shows booked, and I went up on stage with just dot points and then just sort of riffed, and that's, I guess, kind of how I work my material, just with, like, an idea here or there and maybe a line that might work, and then I just try to find my way through that.
Okay.
But
And are you trying to find a line through it that suggests you're trying to win an argument on stage, do you think?
Yes, I kind of have a premise or, like, a contention. I know what I want to say. The point that I'm trying to make, but getting there, I can't write that. If I start writing, like literally writing it, it just becomes wordy and long, and it's not funny. And you could probably hear it on stage if I've written something. It just sounds completely different.
Yes.
If
I got a great note last night from a preview I did where someone said to me, I could sort of see the words on the page.
Really?
Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, but I thought that was a really clever bit. And you're like, yes, it was. Well done. It was a clever thing.
Yeah,
is that what we're trying to do here?
I know. And look, you know what? If you were quote, like if you were to write that down, it looks great on paper, but it's just not a state. Like, for me anyway, like I think Armour actually, like he almost like knows his stuff exactly before he gets on stage.
Yep.
And his style is completely different to mine. Like, mine's silly and kind of just cartoonish almost. And it's a lot of it's in the performance. And you can't really write that on paper. And when I do, it's completely different to my style on stage.
Okay.
So I sort of have to work it out on stage and see what the crowd's laughing at. And then, you know, you dig further there. I can really only write on stage.
What's your relationship to the absolute truth on stage? Are you, because you've got sort of anecdotal stuff, you're telling stories, funny, and you're also making political points or like a wider political point, do you feel that you have a responsibility to tell the story exactly as it happened, or do you feel that you can take poetic license with events?
All the things that I talk about on stage have absolutely happened to me, and sometimes I leave out the the darker bits, like for instance that ASIO story where I got interviewed.
We've got to talk about this. This blew my mind.
I mean, so I got interviewed by the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. It's like a spy agency that completely happened to me.
So they rang you up out of the blue. Work and said, "Can we buy you dinner?
Can we speak to you?" And I was also on the board of the Islamic Council of Victoria at the time. So this is the thing. I was working as a tax consultant. I was still very much engaged with community work, and I was doing stand up. So I was kind of a representative for the community. I used to do the serious media stuff, and so I had some profile as a Muslim spokesperson. So I think ASIO wanted to speak to me because of that.
Yes. Not because you were a random brown guy.
Oh, well, the thing is, I also was just like lots of people do community stuff, but yeah, like there was really no reason for them to interrogate me and to kind of like the thing is. So I met ASIO, and every time I do that bit on stage, people always ask me if that was even true. Did ASIO meet? What would they want to meet? They kind of wanted to freak me out. They would bring up stuff about my family.
So that when you say that, you don't say the word interrogate on stage. You said the word interrogate there. Was it tougher than you're making it out?
It was properly like I was genuinely scared about it. In fact, I've never spoken about this on stage. I only spoke about it on stage after I got legal advice because I wasn't sure if I was properly freaked out. I couldn't tell anybody about that conversation that I had with ASIO until...
Because they told you not to.
They told me not to. And I couldn't even text anybody. On the way to the meeting, I actually texted a friend saying, hey, because I remember Australia was playing Iraq in the soccer qualifiers, or they were playing one of these Gulf nations. And I just texted my friend saying, hey, bro, when you're done at the soccer, please just give me a call. Don't forget to give me a call. Because I didn't want to let them know that I was... They said, don't tell anybody you're meeting me, that you're meeting us. They just said, this has just got to be between us. And they said, if you want to tell someone that you're okay, you can call. They literally said you could tell them that you're okay, but don't tell them that you're meeting us.
You'd need to say, hey, mum, I'm okay.
I'm okay. Like, what a stupid thing to tell someone. So God. I literally just tried to tell my friend. I wanted to tell a friend at least that if I'm to contact me, just at least, I don't know if he got it, but I was freaking out. And it was for me, I felt they just wanted to let me know that they were watching me. And subtly when I had conversations with other people, I found out that similar things had happened to them, that they didn't feel comfortable talking about these
kinds. Is that a news story in Australia? Is that like, because to me, that's like, holy shit, that's like MI6 coming to me and going, we just want to have a chat. And you know, you'd think if you then found out that they'd done that to a lot of people, you'd want to go to the newspapers and go, is everyone cool with the idea that we're all getting not exactly snatched, not exactly bundled into a car?
Yeah.
Okay, they're buying your dinner.
But
that's incredibly intimidating.
I found out it was more common than I had anticipated when I spoke to lots of Muslims about it. And they were very, nervously kind of...
They gave you a round of applause and went, he's in the club. he got bought the dinner. Welcome, now you're a man.
Yeah, and I was like, but I think they want to recruit Muslims to sort of snitch on the community. So yeah, it was weird. It was weird to have that happen to me.
And so you took legal advice on whether or not you could talk about it on stage?
Yeah, yeah.
And what was the advice?
The advice was that I can talk about it on stage so long as I don't mention anything like that related to anything specific, like a specific case or person. So if they were asking me specifically about Muhammad down the road who is plotting something, to not mention that because that is, that would be
conceivably some sort of security threat.
But there was nothing like that. They were literally just asking.
Did they make you sign anything?
They didn't make me sign anything. But the thing is, the whole thing was just, it felt like they... they were just trying to intimidate me. Like they'd say things about my parents splitting up, and they'd drop in things about my family life, like specific things. Not like they won't ask me questions about that, but just to sort of let me know that they know about me, that they know things about my private life, which freaks you. Like imagine if someone met you and said, "So you know your mum, used to get abused by your dad. Like was that when you were 6 or was that when you were 7?" And like just to sort of just to tell you like.
Yeah,
that they know
they're watching.
And that freaked the shit out of me. Like, it was just a scary.
Has there been any fallout from you talking about it on stage? Have you received any double clicks on the phone?
Nothing. I think now I have a bit of a platform that they can't kind of shut me up now. I'm actually a public person, whereas when I was a community person, my stand-up thing was something I did on the side. Okay. And they probably didn't think much of it, but I was just, I was a community
spokesperson. Now you've got a couple of series of your own show and you could very easily do a sketch about that, take some more legal advice, take the piss.
Yeah, imagine if they tried to intimidate me, I could talk about that on stage, it would make some news or something. It would become something that people would talk about. Whereas back then, I think conceivably they thought I would just shut up or just... Yeah, or just if they had a question to ask me in the future, that I would just tell them. I don't know. I'd cooperate. I wouldn't ever meet them. Like, I met them even though they told me that I didn't need to, because I felt that if I, like, you feel like
there's an element. They could disappear you.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. You can just get locked up for 14 days with no lawyer and without being arrested for anything. So it's scary. I never thought I'd be scared because I'm a tough talking idiot. You know, like, I talk tough to my friend. Like, what did a cop pull you over? You just tell them that you know your rights, man. Like, I'm that guy that always gives freaking shitty legal advice to people that, you know.
I took some legal advice from Nazim.
Yes, exactly. You know, so yeah, I can't believe I even met them because I was definitely intimidated.
Before we wrap up, I just want to come back to a couple of things about, more specifically about stand-up. What do you... Actually, here's a thing that I haven't had the chance to ask anyone before. As a person of faith, what's the relationship between your relationship with God and your work on stage? Do you have shitty gigs and bomb and you're able to come, and you're able to come off and go, no, you're comforted by your faith? Because I speak as someone with no faith who is often jealous of other people's faith. I'm like, God, it would be good to be religious.
You know what?
I've
got to say, before I go on stage each night, like, it's not cool to be religious in comedy. Like, it's not like comedy. You know, like, lots of, I think the culture of comedy is pretty atheist. But I say a prayer before I go on stage every night. Like, I'm not a religious comedian. I don't go up on stage and make, you know, sell Islam or whatever. But, you know, if a gig goes shit, I just go, well, you know, it's kind of the way it was supposed to be. You know, I should be happy that I've got a platform and an audience of people here to see me. If I'm feeling shit or if I've had a crappy review, I just think about, you know, I guess religion has taught me to be grateful and to appreciate little things, but which is what a lot of philosophies will teach people. But I think I have a close relationship with my religion. So, yeah, I try to see the brighter side of things. It's not always easy, obviously, because I'm human, but I am often reminded of things that my religion says about being grateful and being tested. And so if things don't go well, I just think, well, this is just kind of part of my journey. So, yeah, I tell myself these things, but often it's, you know, I'm removed from being comforted because I'm just in such a bad place. But, you know, it's just life. So, yeah.
I was just being quiet then to see where that would continue going.
No,
it's interesting to go, obviously, I'm removed from being comforted. That's a really fascinating way of describing that. Yeah, because it would be easy for me as a non-religious person to go, oh, I wish I was religious, because that way there'd be someone there to carry the weight with me, you know.
Be human, but, like, religion is a human pursuit. It's a human endeavour. Like, you are, you know... Yeah, you can believe in something that you think is divine, but at the end of the day, you are aspiring to those standards as a human, as someone that is not, you know, divine or is not God, you know. So we're all in the same boat, according to my religion and according to most ideologies and philosophies and theologies, whatever.
And atheism.
Atheism is exactly that, about the human pursuit of things. And that's what Islam teaches me, that really, well, the Quran and the Prophet, these are examples and doctrine which sort of advise you to make light, to turn these things into your life or to approach them. They're not going to approach you. You need to approach these texts and try to make meaning of them. So that's your individual, personal, intrinsic kind of pursuit. So it's not like God is guiding you or saying, come on, do this. You know, it's all up to you. So really, atheists and people of faith don't have that much to differ on in terms of that. We're all doing our own thing. Things out of your control, well, you can argue where those things come from. And those things are out of my control anyway. Whether you say that is godly or it's ungodly, whatever, they're out of your control. So you can only do what you can do. I don't know if that's I'm religiously informed to have those views, but that's... Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I've answered your question. I've just talked a lot of shit.
Not at all. I think that's a fascinating answer. I like to ask guests, if you were to review yourself... Yeah. What would be your most honest, most searing review of yourself? You're obviously, you know, you're a happy guy, you're a positive guy, you're a successful guy, you've got your own TV show, you've got other projects in the pipeline, and you're doing a show that you're passionate about, that you care about, and you're selling tickets.
Yeah.
It's all going well. Yeah. So what's the downside?
Most critical review.
You know, that you would give yourself, not that other people have said, that you would, what holes would you pick in your own?
I would say that I am someone that sometimes just goes for easy laughs, like knowing when the crowd laughs. Like, you know, I can tell you, that's what I'm going to say. That bit was a bit crowd pleasing. Like, I feel that I can do. Sometimes I feel like I'm better than my material, and I'm smarter than the material that I perform on stage. But I just don't write that way often enough, and therefore I don't take my audience to those places, or I don't bring my audience along for that ride. You know, instead I take them on an easier or a ride that I think is just more comfortable for everybody. And yeah, I think I've probably got. I still need to think about exactly my voice and what I want to say and who the hell I am on stage. Like, I literally have no idea still. I feel like I'm very, 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 very early on in my stand-up career. And which is why I feel weird kind of having a profile as a stand-up, because I don't want people to go, oh, that's that guy, because I don't know who I am yet. I really am so young. This is my first solo show. But I've got some profile, which is scary. So
yeah. Is that scary? Do you feel the weight of, like, don't screw up the profile?
Yeah, it is. Well, exactly. I kind of want to just be that guy who's just starting out with no one watching. Like, someone told me, I think it's probably a popular quote. The worst thing for someone to watch is a comedian growing on stage, and that's what I'm doing. I'm growing on stage, and people are now watching me because of stuff that I've done, and because I've got a profile. And I'd rather do that with no one watching me, or maybe a few people watching me, and then when I'm grown and I feel comfortable in my own skin, then you can come to my show and buy a ticket. But right now, you know, look, I'm doing my best, and I'm putting on my game face, and you fake it till you make it, and that's what I'm doing. So
and I don't want to end this interview without me going, I really enjoyed your show. Thanks, I think, man. It's absolutely worth spending the money.
I feel like I'm gonna be honest on this podcast.
don't talk us out of this, because no, PR will get in touch with me. What the hell did you let Nazim say?
No, we're talking to comedians, right? Like, and yeah, and you know, that's the reality. Where it's showbiz. You're actually presenting the best or the most convincing version of yourself on stage. So yeah, we can all relate. We're just all shit talking. Some of us aren't. Some of us are comfortable in their skin. I'm learning to work out exactly who I am. Shit, this sounds like I've got freaking problems. I've got issues, but you know. Maybe I do. I probably do. I should see someone after this podcast.
This is normally the route that when I'm dealing with people who aren't happy in their skin, happy in their faith, happy in their career, this just turns into a dark hour of
No, I'm actually happy, but I just, you know, as a stand-up, like, it's people are always like, oh, what are you about? I don't know what I'm about yet. Like, you know, I'm talking about certain things now, but I don't know what I'm going to be talking about next week. And, you know, right now I feel like I know how I write, but, you know, then I come across another way of writing or expressing myself, and so, you know, it's hard. I feel like I'm getting better every day, and now I feel embarrassed about someone that saw my show a week ago or 2 weeks ago, because I'm like, well, check out what I'm doing now. Like, you know, so it's, yeah, you always, I don't like watching my stand-up. I don't like watching my comedy, because it's just, you know, I think now I'm so much more mature comedically than I was
last week,
yeah. So, you know, but that's what people, yeah, performers are all like that.
Thanks, man.
So that was Nazim, lovely guy. Thank you to him. Thank you to Soho Theatre for helping me arrange that. And you can get online and find his stuff on YouTube. I'm sure you can find his website. I should be more organised about telling you how to find people on Twitter and how to find their websites. I always try and make the effort to do that. Sometimes, as you know, I'm recording this on the hoof, on the fly. And I don't have that information at my fingertips. I don't even have an internet in front of me. So I'm sure you do. Find an internet, use some of those search algorithms that people have worked very hard on, and work out how to get in touch with and hear from Nazim Hussain. He's a brilliant guy. And dude, you must check out his TV show, Illegally Brown. There's loads and loads of sketches from that online on YouTube. And they are very, very funny. I was really knocked out by them, actually. He's got a real a kind of sketch improv talent as well, bubbling away there under all that brilliant stand-up. So that's everything for now. Thanks to Nathan Wood for co-producing the show. Thank you to Olivia Phipps for her occasional forays into Podmin. She's the Podblin, you might remember from earlier episodes. Thanks to those guys, and I will see you after. I'm currently at Glastonbury. This is a pre-record, which is why it's all over the place. No, it's all over the place, and it happens to be a pre-record. But I am currently at Glastonbury Festival, so if you see me there, come up, and if you're listening to this on the way, then I hope you get in, I hope the weather's nice, and come up, say hi, press a couple of quid into my hand, and say something cool. Speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.